Welcome to Banfield. We've got breaking news tonight. Police in Moab, Utah have released their report about that roadside fight between Gabby Petito and Brian Laundry. The police stop was caught on body cam back in August, and the 12th of August, in fact, you will remember a witness called 911 saying that they saw Brian hitting Gabby. But Gabby told police here on the body cam that she was the one who hit first. The couple was separated for the night, but nobody was arrested. And less than 2 weeks later, Gabby was dead. All suspicions pointed to Brian Laundry as the killer. News Nation's Brian Enten has a copy of the nearly 100-page report. Brian, what is in the report?
Well, first of all, Ashley, the investigator makes clear that there were many mistakes made by the officers in the Moab Police Department, but that none of them were intentional. Number one, the report says that there was probable cause for an arrest. And according to the investigator who looked into all of this, he says the officers should have actually arrested Gabby Petito, that Gabby Petito was the aggressor and that officers made a mistake by not making an arrest and following up.
So, Brian, the unintentional mistakes, this has got to be heart-wrenching for the Moab Police Department. It's also got to be very difficult to make these admissions publicly.
It is. I can tell you that, Ashley. This is very, very difficult for these officers who were involved. They have basically been tormented by this traffic stop and do feel guilt. I mean, you can imagine what they've been going through, and they have not been handling this well. But the department says they will take action. They are going to put new training in place. And we know that the person who did the report, the investigator, his recommendation was that both officers should be put on probation.
So they've said that, you know, separating them was the right move, Brian. However, they should have given them domestic abuse resources. They should have let them know more was available to them. And then in the end, they should have treated it like domestic abuse and not disorderly conduct. But the honest, you know, reality of what they face that day is something they face dozens of times a day, maybe hundreds per month. So have they noted that this is a very difficult science to actually perform in real time in the field?
Yes, they absolutely have. They made that clear in the report. It is easy for anyone to come back and Monday morning quarterback this. And no one could have known that Brian Laundry was going to kill Gabby Petito. And they make that clear in the report. But what you said is important. I mean, they categorized this as a disorderly conduct incident. Had they changed that to domestic violence, things would have been different. There would have been mandatory follow-ups. It would have likely been sent to the prosecutor's office, and they would have been required to give them resources, domestic violence resources. Remember, this traffic stop happened 2 weeks before the last time anyone heard from Gabby Petito. So if things were handled differently, it's possible the outcome of all of this could have changed. Of course, there's no way to know for sure.
So some of the recommendations, and I'm just going to list them out as they listed them out almost verbatim here, is that both officers involved in the Gabby Petito incident be placed on probation, that they get domestic violence training, and that they get legal and other training as well. You know, that's all fine. However, it's a really hard question to ask, and I'm sure it's an impossible question to answer. I'm just going to go there anyway, Brian. Would Gabby Petito be alive today, however, if they had done all the right things?
Again, we just don't know. I mean, obviously, that's what I thought about reading the 99 pages over the last couple of hours. And what was so interesting, actually, is you've read so many of these investigative reports, internal affairs reports. They're usually very, very matter of fact and just fact, 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 fact. But what was so interesting in this report is they actually went there and they actually they brought that up and said that people reading this are likely going to ask that question. And the person who wrote the report, the investigator, said after everything he looked into, it's just an impossible question to answer.
It's an impossible question to answer, and it will haunt us all, you know, forever. And I assume for those officers as well. Brian Enten, just excellent work as usual. Thank you for this update.
Thanks, Ashley.
Brian Enten reporting live for us tonight. I have this other story that hit the wires today. Britney Spears, her family is unraveling live on television. The latest spectacle, her baby sister, Jamie, baby by 10 years, Jamie, was on Good Morning America this morning, insisting that she has always loved her big sister. This despite a veritable war, sometimes words, sometimes finances, between Britney and her dad and her mom. And yes, Jamie Lynn, too. Instagram relationship the two actually share. This is what Jamie Lynn put on her Insta. May the peace of the Lord be always with you. And Britney clapped back. May the Lord wrap your mean ass up in joy today. So that's pretty sad. Will this family ever be right again? Joining us now to talk about that is Rob Shooter. He is the author of The Four-Word Answer. Rob worked with Jamie Lynn while he was the editor at OK Magazine. OK, Rob, why now? Why is Jamie Lynn doing this big media blitz and going on a big show like Good Morning America, where the headlines just ripple through every other media outlet, mine included?
It's a good question, and the answer is very, very easy today for this question. The reason she's doing it is she has a new book coming out. So she has a brand new book out, and she's been working with her book PR people to try and get as much exposure as possible. It started today with a two-part interview on Good Morning America.
Yeah, so there was more of that Good Morning America interview, and I want to play a little bit of it, because you can say what you want about the conservatorship, the, you know, plus decade that Britney felt she was a prisoner of her family, and she blames them all, including Jamie Lynn. But I mentioned that Jamie Lynn was a baby sister by 10 years for a reason, because she was really young when all of this started, and she was also a teen mother. So she had a lot on her plate back then when Britney was melting down. And, I think that's kind of fair. I mean, if you think about it, I think, Britney, if she's holding Jamie Lynn responsible, it's pretty hard to assume that a 17-year-old who's a brand new mother and is in the limelight is going to be able to process everything we know now back then.
Yeah, I think that's a really fair point. I think what Britney would argue here, though, is the conservatorship went on for 13 years. So if she started when she was just 17, that makes her, 27, 28, 29, 30 years old. So along that journey, along those 13 years, Britney feels as if people, particularly people in her family, should have jumped in and made this situation different. Jamie Lynn is arguing that along the road, she did in fact try to do that. She didn't give us any specifics during the interview, but she did claim that she tried to help her sister, and ultimately that backfired on her.
I think, again, everybody who's watching right now, we all have our family strife, right? But as parents and grandparents, we just want our kids to get along. We just want our siblings to get along. And it's so stressful when you see that it's not happening. And then this family is sort of under the Klieg lights. Okay, one other thing that was an issue, Rob, I want you to weigh in on this. And Jamie Lynn. I mean, you worked with her when you were the editor at OK Magazine when she was putting out her pregnancy announcement. So if anybody knows her in this conversation, certainly you. Jamie Lynn performed this medley of Britney's songs at the 2017 Radio Disney Music Awards, and she apparently got a real thrashing by Britney when Britney posted back in July on Instagram this quote: "I don't like that my sister showed up at an awards show and performed my songs to remixes. My so-called support system hurt me deeply." All right, that's a heck of a shot to take at a sibling. I don't know what's going on in Britney's head. Rob, if you follow Britney's Instagram, it's really distressing. She just looks like she has no grip on reality. She has sycophantic fans that call her queen constantly when she does really ridiculous things. Is this family, is this young woman, Britney Spears, ever going to be whole again?
No, she's not. But what she is going to be is in charge of her own destiny. And some people think that might be a mistake, but I think we have to let her have a chance, even if she fails. I think the situation with her sister is really complicated. It's not just about singing her songs. It's about not being there for her. And I know from my Britney insiders that Britney's really angry, not just with the dad, but with the entire family. And now that she has a chance to speak out, I think she's going to. I certainly know what Jamie Lynn did today is not going to mend this relationship. If Jamie Lynn wanted to go on television and make friends again with her big sister, she didn't do it this morning.
It's really upsetting. Like I said, everybody just wants to see, you know, children get along and siblings get along, and it's certainly not happening here. Rob Shooter, good to see you. Thank you.
Take care, my friend.
Okay, another very famous family making headlines tonight, and this family would really rather not be. It's Prince Andrew. He has finally lost his fight to stay out of an American courtroom in the sex lawsuit that he's facing in New York. It's all terribly embarrassing for the royals, as they had hoped to have this whole thing dismissed. But a federal judge today said the case is going full steam ahead. Virginia Roberts Giuffre is suing Prince Andrew, saying that she was trafficked to him at age 17 by serial pedophile Jeffrey Epstein. At that point, she's 17. Andrew was 41. Joining me now to break down what this really means for the prince is Sarah Nathan. She is the editor-at-large for the New York Post. Sarah, thank you so much for joining me tonight. I keep wondering, are we really possibly going to see Prince Andrew doing that public walk in front of the media into the, you know, federal courthouse in New York?
I mean, there's a very real possibility that we could actually see him coming to America. Whatever way we look at it now, he does not have a lot of good options at all. The options he has are he either settles with Virginia or he takes his fight into the courtroom and he tries to protest his innocence, which he keeps doing. And either which way, you end up damned if you do or damned if you don't. You know, either which way, you've got some element of culpability that you end up, you know, coming out with in the end.
Yeah, well, I look at this case very differently than I do normal cases. I sort of assume the settlement first, and then I imagine the intransigence second. At this point, I've got it reversed. I feel as though this family, they can't afford the institution to acknowledge a settlement, to acknowledge behavior like that. Do you think that a settlement is out of the question, or could this royal family snap for the first time and really have to acknowledge some terrible ugliness?
I think Andrew and his lawyers have a very big decision to make. I think if they settle, it's going to be... on the back of settling a potential settlement, it would have to be an acknowledgement, which people close to Virginia Roberts have said all along is all that she ever wanted. She wanted an acknowledgement. She wanted an apology. So if he settles, she gets some kind of financial settlement and she gets this acknowledgement and she gets an apology. And he also manages to protect his mother, the monarchy, and he also protects everybody that he's hurt.
I mean, I don't know. You know, the truth of it is the headlines, these pictures have been blanketing the American press for months, upon months. So if he settles, you don't really get to clear the air there. It's actually worse. So I guess the question is here. They have a lot of money, the royals. They've got plenty of money. What they don't have is an ability to use that money to buy clean image. So would it be worth it for them to just roll the dice, hopefully beat the rap in court, and then be able to try their best to do some, you know, image repair afterwards? Or at this point, would it be best to settle and desperately start with the image repair right away?
Okay, if you settle, then you say sorry, you acknowledge what you've allegedly done wrong, and then you put the whole thing to bed. If you go to court, let's look at that. You go to court, you have got months of discovery that Virginia's very highly paid, very long-term legal team will be looking at. That will include talking to witnesses who allegedly saw things happening in Jeffrey Epstein's house, witnesses who saw Andrew allegedly at Jeffrey Epstein's house. A lot of potentially embarrassing things could come forward in that court before Andrew could even get to the point of being, this thing could be either found guilty or not.
So here's something else that I realized today that I hadn't thought of before. I mean, first of all, this picture was such a huge scandal. This was Prince Andrew and Jeffrey Epstein having a stroll in Central Park. And I remember the New York Post with a front page story saying something like the Queen is not amused. And the story was effectively, she really wants him to sever ties. I think by that point it was too late. You know, I think by that point damage was done, pictures were taken, etc. So here's the tactic that I am really astounded at. That the lawyers for Giuffre have suggested that they may call as witnesses in this case. Buckle up. And if you're at home, grab a whiskey. Princess Beatrice, Andrew's daughter. I don't know what she could attest to other than where he was, because I think they said they had pizza night that night. And then, of course, wife Sarah Ferguson. Talk about a spectacle. So there's Princess Beatrice. I guess Princess Eugenie gets to skate on this one. But holy cow, Sarah, that is a squeeze play like none other.
I mean, exactly. This is the whole thing. Do you really want to go down this really hugely embarrassing, potentially damaging path for the royal family? I mean, you've got, you know, last year, Princess Beatrice, who she got married, she had a baby. His other daughter, Eugenie, had a baby. You know, let them get on with their lives, and they're going to be dragged into this court case. His ex-wife, Sarah Ferguson, is massively behind him. She's a big part of his defense team. She's met his lawyers, as we wrote last week. But the whole thing, can you imagine having your royal dirty washing put out in air for everybody to see? It's going to be awful.
Yeah, I'd put out my dirty washing before I would have a child of mine show up at my trial, my sex trial, and testify, oh God, on my behalf. Like, I, of all the things in this story that is the worst, that one, I think is the worst. And that would just turn, I think, the screws in, pardon the pun, the prince's back. Hey, Sarah, thank you so much. It's been good to meet you, and I hope to have you on the show a whole lot more. You really know your stuff. Thank you. Sarah Nathan joining us, editor-at-large at the New York Post. Okay, I have this other big legal story that's playing out. It's in Michigan. Ethan Crumbly, do you remember that name? 15 years old, alleged school shooter. He was back in court today, at least virtually, anyway. You'll remember that it was his parents that made the big, big news, because they went on the lam after they, too, were charged in connection with his mass school shooting for allegedly providing Ethan with the gun that he used in the massacre, allegedly. We do know 4 people were killed, 4 students. Ethan is still in jail. His hair is growing. He's being held on first-degree murder, terrorism, and gun charges. 15 charged as an adult. Crumbly said very little during his hearing, just the, you know, perfunctory stuff like, yes, and I do understand you and I can hear you, and yes, the Zoom is working. But his defense lawyers, though, had lots to say. They entered a plea of not guilty on his behalf. And while Ethan has been dealing with Zoom court at age 15, his parents, Jennifer and James Crumbly, had their request for bond reduction denied. Prosecutors have also released some brand new details, saying that Ethan's parents ignored numerous warnings about their son before the shooting, from his fascination with Nazi propaganda to text messages that he sent his mother in 2021 saying, quote, there was a demon or a ghost or someone else inside the home. Something else, too, today in the new filings. They indicate that Ethan brought the severed head of a bird to school. It was in a mason jar, and that happened just 3 weeks before the mass shooting. All right, still to come, Harmony Montgomery's mother firing back hard at the authorities, all the while releasing some new pictures of her little girl. We're going to show you those new pictures in just a moment. We're going to take you back to when this little 7-year-old, in these pictures, however, 5-year-old, we're going to take you back to when she was just a little baby. Mom admits she's made mistakes in the 2-year disappearance of her daughter. She says, however, there are plenty of people who share the blame. And next, she's pointing the fingers. Welcome back to Banfield. Harmony Montgomery's mother is firing back the New Hampshire Division of Children, Youth and Families. Yesterday, we shared a statement with you from the DCYF. They were answering questions about their actions before Harmony disappeared in October of 2019. And frankly, they had to. Because honestly, how could a then five-year-old girl just vanish without anyone sounding the alarm, including family services, the police, and of course, Harmony's own parents? Today, the little girl's mother, Crystal Sorey, released some never-before-seen photos of Harmony as a baby, along with this statement to News Nation's Brian Enten that reads, "As a mother who has confronted addiction, I realize I too have failed Harmony in the past. But the safety nets in place that were supposed to protect Harmony during my battle included DCYF and law enforcement. They failed my little girl. Battling addiction is common in this country. Recovery is less common, but I took the necessary steps to do that. Once I did recover, I kicked and screamed against the legal challenges to find out where Harmony was and if she was safe. Both DCYF and police failed to answer me during those periods. Today, they wish to minimize that. I've been honest about my past. Are they?" Again, statement from Crystal Sorey to our Brian Enten, mom of Harmony, with these new photos. You know, we've been looking into the DCYF's past, and we're learning that they were part of a third call that went to Harmony Montgomery's home in 2019. We knew about two calls, but there was a third, according to a police incident report. Officers were called to the home because a neighbor was worried about Harmony living there. The neighbor said the family was squatting, worried that they were using a generator with a bunch of extension cords in the house. Harmony was not removed from the home on that date. According to the police report, the officer found food in the home and the generator running. The report ends with the words, all is well and still working with Demetrius from DCYF. Demetrius. Yes, it was familiar to me as well. If it sounded familiar to you, it's because you probably heard it on this show on Monday, out of the mouth of Harmony's mom, Crystal Sorey. She mentioned that name to Brian Enten when she was interviewing with him while describing the runaround that she was getting from authorities while she was trying to see her daughter back in 2019.
I've made reports. I've talked to desk people at DCF office because I didn't have a certain extension because Demetrius wasn't on the case anymore, which was the person that was supposed to remove her that didn't. He knew Adam personally. He was Adam's DYS counselor. So he was a conflict of interest from the beginning. So the three times they were supposed to remove her, they didn't because he knew him personally.
We've reached out to the DCYF for more information about the visits and to Harmony's home and Demetrius's role in this whole investigation. And so far, they have not responded. But I mean, look, put it all together. It certainly does appear that the system, at least in part, failed Harmony Montgomery, and this story ain't over yet. You know, it turns out that the art of locating missing children, it's more science, actually, than art. The first few hours after a child goes missing are the most crucial because the chances of finding them alive diminish exponentially with every passing hour. There are safety measures in place, like the Amber Alert, that notify the public right away when a child disappears. But it hasn't always been this way. Unless you're close to around, I don't know, 50, 60 years old, you may not know that the Amber Alert was inspired by a real child named Amber. 26 years ago this week, on January 15th of 1996, this little girl, Amber Hagerman, was abducted while riding her bike with her little brother, Ricky, in Arlington, Texas. I know this story well because I was there. I covered this story for KDFW in Dallas. 4 days after Amber went missing, her naked body was discovered in a creek almost 5 miles away. Her throat had been slashed, and to this day, her murder remains unsolved. One woman who lived through the Amber Hagerman story as it played out on the news was so shocked to learn that there was no system in place to alert people about missing kids that she stepped up to the plate herself. After the break, you're going to meet the woman who made Amber Alert a household name. Welcome back. January 1996, 26 years ago this week, Diana Simone was watching the evening news when she saw coverage of the abduction of Amber Hagerman. She wanted to help, but she had no information about who or what she should be looking for, and she decided to do something about it. She had an idea. A partnership between law enforcement and the media that would broadcast critical information about abductions as soon as they happened. It included a description of the victim, a description of the kidnapper, plus the make, color, and license plate of the vehicle. Simone's idea eventually became the Amber Alert System nationwide, named for Amber Hagerman. More than 1,000 children have now successfully been recovered through the Amber Alert system. And I am pleased to be joined by the woman who started it all, Diana Simone. Diana, it's so good to meet you, even this way. I'm still trying to process that it's been 26 years. And at the same time, I'm trying to process how sad I am that this case that I worked on in Dallas, Texas, still isn't solved.
I know. That is a tragedy.
And it must be particularly tragic for you because so much good came out of it, but not, you know, for Amber's family.
Not for Amber's family, yeah.
So, listen, walk me through this because, you know, you wanted to help. And generally, we're just all ordinary citizens, and very few of us think that we can actually do something and make change nationwide, let alone save 1,000 children. But you had a feeling you could do something. So take me back to that that heavy moment.
Well, I think I was very, I can be very pragmatic at times. And I think I was very frustrated by the fact that to me, it is impossible to drive a large vehicle through a densely populated area and not be seen. So when you stopped and thought about it, there is no way people did not see that vehicle. They simply didn't notice the vehicle because they didn't know what they were looking at or what they were looking for. So to me, that became the problem. And it was the question of how to solve that problem, how people could be notified quickly, what, you know, what they could do. Why, I don't know, why I thought, I didn't think I specifically could make a difference. I thought a good idea could make a difference. And it truly was a team effort. There were so many people who took part in it. I've like mentioned before, my friend, the late Reverend Tom Stoker, was the one who suggested the radio. Because I was originally thinking a voluntary cell phone program. Just different people. I had an idea, but I had absolutely no way to implement the idea. And
by the way, when you say voluntary cell phone program, like I remember I had a Motorola flip phone. I mean, we were just getting cell phones, a whole bunch of us back then. I also was astounded, Diana, to learn that that the first two Amber Alerts, like the tests, they didn't go so well. They didn't really yield any results. And I think they were considering scrapping the plan until number three. What happened on number three?
We had a rescue within 45 minutes. There was a rescue of a kidnapped infant within 45 minutes.
I mean, that's something. And did you know about that? Did you find out about that right away?
I found out about that later on. Yeah.
Oh, and yet, you were anonymous for like 6 years. Nobody knew. And somebody wrote an article. And tell me if I'm wrong here, but somebody wrote an article saying, gee, if only we knew who came up with the idea. And a friend of yours came forward and said, it's Diana Simone.
Yeah. Yeah. And they had to verify the original letter when that came through. But it was Bud Kennedy in the Star Telegram who said, if we only knew who she was. And that was just before it went national. And I was outed at that point.
You were outed. It's a good thing, Diana. I, for one, I'm glad to be able to meet you and say thank you. You've, like I said, you've saved 1,000 children. You went to the White House. I think we have a picture of you with President Bush, right? I'm guessing that this would be George W. Bush, right?
Yes.
Tell me about that moment.
Yeah, it was absolutely incredible. It was such an incredible honor. But if you look behind the president, you will actually see some of the children and the families who were rescued as a direct result of the alert. And that there are no words to describe what a heartwarming and wonderful experience that was to actually meet those families and to be with those children. So it was all.
Well,
just
you're going to have to come up. You're going to come up with some words right now because I want to know what it was like. I am assuming it was pre-COVID, so you could give big hearty hugs to parents and children. Yes. Tell me about that.
And lots of tears and just a wonderful sharing with just some incredible people, you know, who have been through an awful lot. And, but, you know, I do want to point out that, and I say this so often, but I help make it possible. But the American people are who make it work. The people who are out there, who spot those vehicles, who make those phone calls and bring those kids home safe, those are the heroes of this situation, in my opinion.
Well, look at you deflecting. The truth is, you're right. It's great when people do the right thing and they keep their eyes peeled when they see these notices, but they wouldn't know what to do. They wouldn't know what to do if it weren't for you. So, Diana, thank you for, thank you for being here tonight. And Diana Simone, thank you for being the guardian angel of missing children everywhere. And let's keep our fingers crossed on Amber's, you know, resolution, and maybe you and I can meet again that topic.
Never give up.
Wouldn't that be? No, never. All right. Well, great to meet you. Thank you again.
Thank you so much.
And tomorrow night on News Nation, I'm happy to tell you that News Nation Prime with Marnie Hughes is going to have a whole special report about the abduction and murder of Amber Hagerman. News Nation went to Arlington to retrace her final steps, and you can see that all tomorrow night at 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 Central, right here on News Nation. Don't miss it. Okay, cheating your way to greatness? Did a Midwestern kid dupe an Ivy League school and the Rhodes Scholar Committee? How do you even pull that off? You're about to find out. It is fair to say that Rhodes Scholars are some of the smartest, most successful people on the planet. Only 32 people are chosen to be one each year worldwide. Some of the past Rhodes Scholars from this country include Bill Clinton, Senator Bill Bradley, Kris Kristofferson, the singer, Rachel Maddow, the broadcaster, as well as other broadcasters like George Stephanopoulos and Susan Rice, cabinet member, and Supreme Court Justice David Souter, folks who have done pretty darn well for themselves. Mackenzie Fairston is not like them, even though she too became a Rhodes Scholar. That's because Mackenzie lost that scholarship and may lose her Ivy League graduate degree as well after an investigation discovered that she may have lied her way to the top. She said she was the first generation to head off to college, that she grew up poor with a history of abuse, bouncing back and forth between foster homes. That was all in the applications, conversations. Still, she earned straight A's, was accepted into grad school at University of Pennsylvania and Ivy League itself, right? And eventually she landed that Rhodes Scholarship. And one anonymous tip later, authorities discovered that Mackenzie actually went to a $30,000 a year private school in suburban St. Louis called the Whitfield School. Turns out her mom was a radiologist, her home, a pretty sweet tree-lined street. Mackenzie even spent time riding horseback as a kid. What about that application? Joining us now is Isabel Vinson, columnist for the New York Post, who has been covering this story. I just have one really simple question, Isabel. How on earth can you pull something like that off?
I think it's a combination of things. For one, the common application that's used by like a million apply to universities in the United States. I mean, there's a lot of emphasis on overcoming adversity. So students feel that they have to, you know, emphasize something that was negative in their lives. I mean, there's a lot of the essay questions are geared to that. Secondly, I mean, the universities themselves, and speaking to, you know, and asking that same question that you just asked me to the tutors who work with these kids, like the preparatory people have said, you know, that the universities can't possibly fact check everything that students are telling them in this personal essay that they write. So I think that's how she got away with it.
So, you know, obviously, this is really embarrassing for, I would say, the university, Penn, and for Oxford and the Rhodes Scholarship. What do they do to overcome this?
Well, they're conducting, well, both of them are conducting investigations. And actually, Mackenzie took herself out of the Rhodes Scholarship. I mean, she, after the allegations surfaced, she just, you know, she said no, so to her credit. But she is suing the university now, alleging that this was a conspiracy against her, that she did spend, I mean, some of the stuff, like, let's, you know, let's be honest about some of it. Like, some of the stuff she did say was accurate. It's true she spent a year in a foster home after she had an incident with her mother in which her mother maybe inadvertently, she didn't throw her down the stairs. It seems like it was an accident. And her mother was charged with 3 counts of child abuse, charges that were dropped about 5 months later. But still, she did end up going to a series of foster homes in 2014. So, you know, I am sure she built, you know, on that truth and perhaps made it, you know, a lot worse than it was.
To that point, I just want to jump in because I actually have the quote from the prosecutor about the claims that Mackenzie made about her mom. I mean, she'd said some pretty, you know, distressing things like that she was caked in blood and the hospital report didn't reflect that. And the prosecutor said,
Yeah.
So here's what the prosecutor said. The more I learned about the case, the less certain I became about what really happened. Tell me this. Obviously, there's some bad blood going on between Mackenzie and her mom. Her mom's name is Carrie Morrison. Is Carrie Morrison siding with her daughter to help sort of push her daughter's lawsuit against the school along? Or is the school employing the testimony of Carrie Morrison saying your daughter is making everything up to us, just like she did to, you know, to the police about you?
I mean, I don't know the answer to that, but Carrie Morrison in 2014 lost her job as a radiologist at a hospital in St. Louis. She did come out and say that, you know, Mackenzie is very much loved by her family, but nobody's commenting on this. Obviously, there's
just
litigation.
Just incredible. I'm going to keep up with you on this one, Isabel. It's a fascinating story. Thank you. Thank you for being here tonight. It's nice to meet you.
Thank you very much. Likewise.
Okay. Coming up, do you think you've had a busy day? Try being Dr. Sanjay Gupta. He is a host, a medical correspondent, an executive producer, a 60 Minutes contributor, a leader in 2 hospitals, and he just happens to practice brain surgery every week. How does he do it? His secret is next. Every month, I sift through my Rolodex looking for friends in high places. And when I find one, I call and I ask if they'll sit down with a few hundred young folks in broadcasting on Zoom to answer questions about how these lofty folks made it to where they are. It is a program that I decided to call Rising Tide, the value in mentoring others. And today, Dr. Sanjay Gupta was my VIP mentor. Sanjay is the busiest man I know. He is CNN's chief medical correspondent. He is host and producer of the podcast and series Chasing Life. He's a 60 Minutes contributor. He's an associate professor and an associate chief of neurosurgery at 2 hospitals. He's a best-selling author 3 times over, and he happens to perform life-saving brain surgery every week. Let that sink in. So, naturally, as a mentor, there was a lot of ground to cover today and some really, really good questions for Sanjay. Take a look. Okay, Jim Hart from Phoenix has this question for you, Sanjay. What motivated you to go on Joe Rogan and do more journalists today have a responsibility to do interviews like that?
Yeah, no, I'm glad I went on Joe Rogan. I think we are increasingly living in a pretty increasingly siloed media environment. I guess that's probably no surprise to anybody. And this has some sort of overlap with the notion of confirmation bias. So I do think there's an obligation for people to get outside their silos and have conversations. I think for that reason, just to break down the walls of those silos, but also it gets pretty toxic, I think, sometimes, because if people aren't talking to each other, I think sometimes they're just assuming the worst of each other, of the other, you know, whatever it may be. So being able to actually have conversations is important.
So our next VIP mentor in the series is Lisa Ling. She's host and executive producer of This Is Life with Lisa Ling on CNN. And she's going to go live on me on Zoom February 9th at 3 p.m. And it's free, everybody. Sign up for your free invitation. Go to newsnationnow.com/risingtide. Or if you can't remember that, just Google Rising Tide and Ashley Banfield. And you can join us for the other mentors that are coming up as well, like Mika Brzezinski and Billy Bush and Sam Champion and Bob Costas and Savannah Guthrie. And look at all those awesome faces, including S.E. Cupp and Dana Bash and Dan Abrams. And I have too many to name. This is awesome. RV Levin, Meghan McCain, Deborah Norville. Join up and ask your questions. And I'll see you back here tomorrow night.